Hello, I'm Anne Mossop, Sydney Writers Festival Artistic Director. This episode of our podcast was recorded as part of the 2024 Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Good morning, readers. We are here today to celebrate the elemental power of storytelling. And so let us begin by acknowledging the story of this place. We meet today on the lands of the Gadigal people.
Recording in progress.
Custodians of the land and waterways, first peoples, first poets, first dreamers, first art makers, first storytellers. May we endeavour to cherish and protect the stories of those who have come before us, to hear their beauty and heed their lessons. My name is BJ Silcox. I'm a writer and a book critic, and this year I had the best job in the world. I was the chair of the Stella Prize judging panel. What makes the Stella Prize magnificent is also what makes it, as a judge, entirely maddening, because every genre is eligible. So Tudor bodice rippers rub shoulders with experimental poets. Big-hearted YA novels compete with white-hearted investigative journalism. This year we considered 227 books. One of them was a deliciously esoteric poetry collection where every single poem was inspired by an episode of I Dream of Jeannie. Another was a volume of deeply felt, deeply researched essays about the taboos and medical cruelties of miscarriage. Now, how are you meant to find a winner in this grand, glorious, brain-melting scrum? The answer is Alexis Wright. The answer is praiseworthy. A genre buster, a canon crusher, an epic. Here's what I had to say on Stella Prize night. Praiseworthy is mighty in every conceivable way. Mighty of scope, mighty of fury, mighty of craft, mighty of humour, mighty of language, mighty of heart. Praiseworthy is not only a great Australian novel, perhaps the great Australian novel, it is also a great Wanyi novel, and it is written in the wild hope that one day all Australians might understand just what that means. Now, as I said on the night, I don't understand. I don't understand what that means, not yet. But I can feel history calling to me in the pages of Alexis Wright's novel, calling to all of us, and imagine if we listened. Alexis has had to endure a truly horrendous amount of praise in the last few weeks, and much of it from me, so I am not going to drown her in any more, nor am I going to waste more of our precious time regurgitating her achievements like some kind of Wikipedia robot, because what I am dying to know is how on earth she managed the epical feat, the magisterial majesty of Praiseworthy. Let's find out. Please join me in welcoming Alexis Wright. Good morning, Alexis. Let's get a big from the crowd. Good morning, Alexis.
Woo! Okay.
Good morning. Yeah. Alexis.
All right, BJ.
Let's get started. Praiseworthy is epic. Who have been the epic storytellers in your life, Alexis, in real life and on the page?
Let's see now. Well, the epical storytellers were been many, I think. I come from a storytelling culture, and we have big epics of stories that go right across the country, embedded in the country, the powerful law stories, and they're kept strong to this day. By your senior law holders and people of great wisdom, and they're also very good storytellers. And so I grew up in this sort of environment, particularly with my grandmother, who at a very young age, about three, I'd run away from my mum and jump the front fence and go down to my grandmother's place, and which was a number of blocks away, and be with her. I just love being with her and listening to her, and been taking on long walks around the bush with her, and listening when she was talking to other people and talking to family, and family members themselves. You know, the stories people told. And then I went to work in our world, and And I was really privileged to work with some really remarkable people, people of great wisdom, with very close connections to the land and as story holders and keepers, and with some very fine people our Aboriginal political leaders. Brilliant people, great storytellers, and because I showed an interest as well, people like to tell me stories, and usually would call me aside. I want to tell you a story, and usually it was to gather an audience around why they told a story, to me. But there was everyone listening and everyone laughing and having a great time. So, I had a lot of teachers, and plus I've learned from writers from across the world. That's what I, decided to do when I was thinking of writing in a very serious way. I learned to explore writers, from across the world. I actually like reading probably more than I like writing. So it comes from that, long background.
So Praiseworthy isn't a small book that got out of hand. You said in your acceptance speech for Stella, I believe literature must meet the scale of what is happening in the world. What was the kernel of the idea, the big questions that catalysed this very big book?
The big questions that I was concerned about is global warming, and I have been for some time, and have read a lot of material, what the science, the scientists were saying about global warming, and also, very, closely attuned to what's happening in our world as Indigenous people. I've worked, in our world for a long time, and I see, decades in and decades out of bad policies of government saying that they, govern for Aboriginal people, but what the reality on the ground is a lot different. And I've worked for a number of senior elders across Central Australia, the most respected men and women who, They wanted to see an overhaul of the governance arrangements in the Northern Territory, because they could see that what was happening and that things were not getting better, it was getting worse. And then we had the intervention in 2007, and that lasted, and now we have closing the gap. And recently we had the Australian Productivity Commissioner's report saying that there should be structural change structural change and systematic change to give Aboriginal people more power in their decision making, and we've always said that we govern ourselves and that we need to be able to plan our own future, and that's just not happening. But what the Productivity Commissioner said, structural change and systematic change, I've heard that for decades. So it concerns me, and it concerns me that, we're having longer summers, hotter summers, and people are on communities in Northern Australia in particular, are living in really dire conditions. A lot of people, they can't afford, to pay for electricity to keep it running all the time, let alone have air conditioners or fans, things like that, that a lot of people take for granted. And we do take it for granted, but things may change in the future as the world becomes hotter and warmer. There may well be, millions more people landless and without country. And very needy. And so I was concerned about where does that place us as Aboriginal people? We can't sort of expect any support, real support at the moment. What will happen to our future in this sort of scenario? So that was some of the issues that was that was on my mind when I was thinking about writing Praiseworthy. The big monumental issues, we're living in unprecedented times, but Aboriginal people have been living in unprecedented times for a very long time. And I was thinking about, well, where are we going? And I think you've said, and or Cheryl, as one of the other judges, as Widespread, one of the main characters, said, what he says in the novel is, what's plan A or what's plan B or is there any plan at all? So that's some of the reasons.
Those questions have been haunting you for a decade. Praiseworthy is the work of 10 years of thinking and writing and research. Can you take us through what it looks like to do the preparatory work for a work this big? What have you done over the last 10 years? What kind of research, what kind of thinking? How does a book like this come together? Because it's not all writing time. There must be an extreme amount of time that's embedded thinking and working and talking and collaborating and consulting.
Well, in that time, I was also writing Tracker. I started Tracker and Praiseworthy at the same time. And
both of which have won the Stella.
So it's incredible, really, that they both sit side by side now, and they you know, two books that started together, and Tracker took 6 years to complete, and a big book, and Praiseworthy kind of became in the shadows a little bit because I had to get that book finished first. And then as soon as that Tracker finished, I began the position at Melbourne University as the Babavia Chair in Australian Literature. And that lasted for 4.5 years. And it was a big position. I really wanted to make it work because we don't get those opportunities given to us as writers. Or for literature in this country, it doesn't happen that often. And this position was given by a great donation by John Wiley and his wife Miriam Babavia Wiley to set up this position at Melbourne University. So I really wanted to make that position work. And so I worked hard at it, but I enjoyed it. It was a very big learning curve. But with I continued on with Praiseworthy. I knew it had to be, you know, on a very broad canvas. And but it was good actually to take time with the book, and to think about it, you know, and keep thinking about it. Because even if I'm not sitting and writing a book, I'm thinking about it all the time. If I take on a project, you know, to write a book, in that I'm challenging myself to do it in a certain way. I continue thinking about it, and wondering how I'll bring it together in all that time. So that, yeah, I don't mind doing that. It's what I enjoy. I love writing, and what I do all the time, I think about a book, I dream about a book, I write notes. I have a collection of 12 notebooks for this book, and they're full of all ideas, thoughts, imaginings, and. So that's one thing. I started Praiseworthy by going to the Darwin Museum when I was up studying working with Tracker to study a display of butterflies from that area. And I continued studying butterflies and watching butterflies all through the book. And it was the day after the book was published. I was walking in a oval with bush all surrounding it, up north from where I live, and I found this beautiful butterfly. It wasn't alive anymore. But I think it was a gift. It was so unusual. It was such a beautiful butterfly. I believe in, you know, gifts and things that come from, you know, our ancestors, perhaps. And
thinking of the butterfly and what a powerful, beautiful metaphor it is inside and outside of the book. As we were reading it, all of the stellar judges were reaching for metaphors to describe what it felt like to read your book. So one of us described it like climbing a great mountain. Someone else described it as sort of sitting next to a grand boulder. Someone else described it as surrendering to an ocean and just feeling the great power of a sea. And then one of the other judges described it as holding a bird and knowing that you couldn't hold it too tight, but that you're holding something alive and precious. And I think that it sort of calls on metaphors. Did you have a metaphor in your head about how it was to pull together something that was so big, that was so expansive? Did you have something like that in your head about what you were building?
Probably not. probably not.
Yeah.
And perhaps if I knew all the answers before I started, I probably wouldn't start. And I if you know the journey that you have to take beforehand, you probably wouldn't begin. And it's a journey that you take, and you have to be prepared for it in a way, but I know that I'm a very determined person. I think I got this from my mother about what determination is, and I'll continue on until I finish. I worked on this book, every page, every line, until I was sure it all stood up, and it was full, it's I don't want, you know, I work until I know the book won't fall over. It won't fall over for me. But it's interesting what you say about how people saw the judges saw the book. And it is like holding, you know, parts of it is like holding something precious, because I find things that are really precious. You know, the world is a precious place. Everything in it is precious, and down to the little butterflies and the beetles and the hopping mouse, and I find joy in almost anything, and I wanted to try to bring that joy in the book, and that came to me, you know, I think that came from my grandmother as well, is that her total joy in things. She had no electricity, for instance, in her house, and she loved torches. Just very small things. Or she had a way of describing why things are, you know, as they are in nature, and it comes from a cultural understanding. So, but I wanted to try and capture all that. You know, I like to try to, you know, I talk about the old times, you know, that the old times are important. No time has ever been, you know, resolved. It came from Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican writer.
What it's really clear is, like, this book is, you know, has big questions, serious questions, furious questions, deep and dark questions, but it also does have that lightness and joy in it, and it's also scabrously funny. And this was the thing that really came across, like, and I urge everyone in the audience to read it, because I was listening to it on the train again coming up from Canberra yesterday, and I got stuck for an extra hour, and it was wonderful. I was listening to it in my headphones and laughing, like laughing out loud. It's scabrously funny. Where did you get so funny, Alexis? How did you get so funny? Did you conceive of it as a comic novel, as a satire, or is life just absurd?
Life is absurd. As Aboriginal people, I think one of the things that we've learned from government policy, perhaps, is the absurdity. And we see absurd things every day. And we make up big epical stories about some of these things. And they're so funny. People retell these stories and they build on it and make it more funny. I think it's an ancestor-given ability to this humour and to be able to carry our burden lightly. You know, we'd carry big burdens, no doubt about it. We work very hard, but we also have a ability to make that burden lighter, so it makes us stronger and to carry it. As we move forward. And I'll mention Italo Calvino. That's something else I learned from his book, Six Memos for the New Millennium, his last book, where he has an essay on lightness. He talks about the shaman of Indigenous peoples, you know, in other parts of the world, but it's the same. Being able to carry that burden as they move, you know, forward and find solutions to some of the problems that they have. And I think that's very much a similar situation in our world. I'm actually, you know, I tell jokes all the time. I don't come across like that. I might come across as very, very serious, but I like to laugh and I have fun and all the time I just enjoy being alive. I really do. And I've been with so many people who are like that. And we laugh and we have fun and we tell stories and I guess it just comes in the book. You get to the stage where you're writing where the joy comes in it, and if it didn't, you'd just about kill yourself. You know, if you couldn't find something joyous in the world, you know, and that's what part of being alive is about. Well, it is for me. You know, I'll tell you, my husband doesn't. I tell jokes. They're very quite lame jokes, and I think they're funny. And I could have a good laugh at myself, you know. And it's, you know, my husband thinks that's quite, you know, it's not a great thing to be laughing at your own jokes.
My husband says the same thing. I tell jokes in the car, and he says, "You can joke, or we can drive, but we can't do both." In the book is not only are there jokes in it and the stories are absurd and funny, but there's also a kind of levity built into the very language of it. Like, you're having a lot of fun with the wordplay, with the very, like, breaking the language apart, putting it back together, and some of it is incantatory and sounds like prayer, and then you swear a lot. It's excellent. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of cunting and fuckery in this book.
Is there? I better do a word check on it and have it taken out in the next edition.
No, take all those swear words out. Keep it. It's delightful.
Take all the fun out. Yeah. I've got to the stage where I really enjoy writing, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I made a decision long ago that. You know, I'd always take risks. Always challenge myself, and I do say other things too. I write from the sovereignty of my own mind, you know, and my own imagination. And I don't like to be put in a box, you know, about how I should write or what I should write. And so, if someone even, you know, hints that I should do this or something, I'll do the very opposite. I think, you know, I've been doing it for a long time. I've been writing for a long time. I've been thinking for a long time and how to do it. And I'm just finding some joy in life, I think, as well as dealing with some of these hard questions. And I wanted to show the world as this great place, you know. And let's take a moment and try to think about the future, you know, and what the science is telling us that we have to, and if we want to keep on making, you know, keep on having this great place, this only place that we can live on, and not only us, this, you know, all everything else that's alive in this world, it has a right to be here too. And it's not for us to destroy, you know, the world, you know, for ourselves or for anything else. And it's a good place. And let's look after it. That's all I'm trying to say in what I do.
Let's set readers up who haven't necessarily opened the book yet with the kind of the opening dilemma of the book. Can you talk to us about the town of Praiseworthy and the haze that settled over the top of it?
Haysworthy is a fictional place. It's not any particular place. I guess it comes from my consciousness. My consciousness is formed by a number of things in reality, but this is a fictional place. And it's an Aboriginal world, and a haze, an ochre-coloured haze, is settled on above this community, this place called Praiseworthy. And it's a haze that won't go away. It's an oppressive haze. It's it's made up of. I can read you just a small part of what the haze is. The story goes, Hate Place was a monument of the moment for some of the poorest people on earth. A hard bit of magic grown from a corpus of ancient stories that have been scattered into mystery by broken spirits creating hellfires. All those eternally wandering fragments of ancient words were coming together and forming the lines of stories entombed in smoke clouds circumnavigating the planet. Now, a ghostly windstorm from out of nowhere came more frequently, came to this place blowing dry leaves, burnt leaves, ash leaves, and spoke of the tragedies in the epical pirates of life. The wind looked at the remains of life in this place, then blew and blew these fragments away in mountainous serpentine waves that hit the soul world of an even greater local spirit. And there, dust, ash, memories written on broken butterfly wings with black soot, all backed up into an ochre-coloured haze that ended up sitting permanently over the flatlands of the blessed be thou and the more blessed be I.
So this extraordinary haze that's so thick and dark that it sits over, the people of Praiseworthy try and blow it up, scare it away with a scarecrow. They build a temple to it and try and get tourists in to get the tourist dollars, and they try and monetize it. There's all this wonderful way that they interact with this haze, and that's where the kind of central absurdity and question of this novel comes from, right? How do you either get rid of the haze or work out a way to make it work for you?
Well, that's right. They send a butterfly to Canberra, for instance, and to tell the government about the haze, and it has a message, but the government in Canberra, by the time this butterfly gets down there, it doesn't, it shoots the butterfly, and the butterfly eventually comes back. And there's all sorts of stories about the haze, and it's an oppressive haze. People do want it to go away. They try to nuke it, and they want the government to nuke it, and this is what they want. But nobody else can see this haze except the people there at Praiseworthy. Yeah, and then the government saying, Whether people say that, well, we can't see the haze, you know, it's not there, but people say it is there, and we need to get rid of it. And yes, place called Praiseworthy, they even bring in, you know, just about every kind of religion there is in the world, and they build, you know, little churches, or, you know, makeshift churches from cardboard boxes and, you know, and all sorts of rubbish, and, you know, a place called Church Street and steeples, and to see if they could bring any added power to or the ancestral power, you know, to deal with some of these things. And that's a big story in the book as well. And but this haze dies.
Yeah, and then out of the great sort of conundrum of what to do with this haze comes a self-appointed hero, Causeman Steele, who has a get-rich-quick scheme. Can you tell us about Causeman Steele?
Yes. It is a get-rich scheme, but get rich quick scheme, but it's more than that. He has a dream. He's worried about climate change and what's going to happen, you know, to Aboriginal culture and the Aboriginal sovereignty, the Aboriginal world in the future, and with all this catastrophe that's going to happen with global warming. And how it's going to pan out for an Indigenous world that can't expect any help now, and probably less so in the future. And so he has a dream, and in this dream he has a glimpse, just a moment's glimpse of a dream he's somewhere in the nighttime in the bush, and from behind all the spin effects in the bush, he sees this donkey, and it's a certain shade of grey. It's a platinum coloured donkey. Now, all donkeys are grey, but he sees this donkey that has a particular powerful hue, you know, the kind of greyness, you know, of power, or Mercedes-Benz perhaps, or the army, and or you know, rocket ship and bombs. It's a powerful color of gray, and so there's descriptions of this power, this color gray in the book as well. And he believes it's the ancestors saying you have to find this creature. This creature is going to be the answer, you know, for your future. And he has this idea, you know, how, you know, his dream is, how is he going to, and he's obsessed with this, how is he going to take his people into the future, you know, into this global warming future, this burning world, the hot load that's coming, and that we're already in. Anyway, and how is he going to take these people in the future over the burning planet, and to be able to tell to survive and tell the tale on the other side, just like the ancestors have brought us to this day, you know, over 60,000 years, and they didn't. And I thought really hard about lots of the questions in this book, and the questions about desire and the questions about hope. We have a lot of people telling Aboriginal people that we must have hope, always have hope. You must never lose hope. And I thought, well, I don't think our ancestors, you know, when they were confronted with a changing climate or an ice age or, you know, anything, you know, quite big difficulties in past times. I don't think they just sat around saying, well, you know, we got to hope. We better have hope, or we must have hope, and we'll depend on hope to survive. I don't think they did that. I think they worked out how they're going to survive, and get there, and got to get us here to this time, and so. Cosman Steele, Widespread or Planet, his other two names, because of, you know, his planetary ideas and his widespread vision. He sets out on this journey and he's broken down Sedan and nothing but his brain power to try to find this donkey out of 5 million feral donkeys that we have in Northern Australia. And I haven't seen the 5 million donkeys, but the scientists who study these things, they say there are 5 million donkeys and feral donkeys in Northern Australia. And so he has 5 million donkeys to choose from to try to find this particular shade of a donkey that's plat, you know, this particular shade of grey. And he does. He believes, you know, he works really hard at this. I mean, it's not easy. He's going over back roads and roads that don't even exist in the bush, and he's traveling thousands of kilometres to try to capture this particular donkey. So, and he has to depend on that glimpse that he had in a dream of what this colour grey really looks like. And so it can be quite confusing, you know, even for him. And he's a miracle man. And so he catches this, you know, a donkey, and he can only take one back at a time. It's only Sedan. He shoves the donkey in the back seat. And when he believes he's found the right donkey and he's actually captured it, he gets back to Praiseworthy. And under the haze, he's got back after all this huge journey that might have taken months, and only to find that when he sees it in the light of Praiseworthy, it's the wrong donkey, and it's not a platinum donkey at all, and it's the wrong colour grey. So he ends up having hundreds of the wrong colour grey donkey in Praiseworthy. So, but he does find it eventually, and it's quite an old donkey, and he is a quarrelsome donkey. It's a stubborn donkey, and it's not really open to the idea that it will be the master or the leader of this huge pack of donkeys carrying, you know, for us in the future. You know, it doesn't really feel it's up to being the master of this international transport conglomeration. And and the course tells it, well, you know, stop being stupid. Of course you are. You know, you can do it. You can do it. And anyway, this is the story.
I think the readers in the audience, our potential readers, can already see that you've got something of sort of almost biblical heft and then a 700-page donkey joke. And it's an extraordinary collision. We're running out of time. And, Alexis, I want to ask you about how... talk about praise, not Praiseworthy, but praise. You have received so many accolades for this book and previous books, and I want to ask you, you've moved from being in a situation where you thought you might only ever write one book and publish one book to being the mighty Alexis Wright. And I want to ask whether or not that sense of reputation and the praise you receive and the attention, is it helpful? Is it encouraging? Or does it feel like pressure? Does it hinder you? Are you still able to write in the way you want to write now that you have so much reputational heft?
I don't really think about, you know, reputation so much. I mean, that's really nice and comforting. I don't know if it gives me a lot of confidence. Probably makes me less confident. I lead a simple type of life, and I'm very happy to be gardening. I'm very happy to be in the bush, and those are the rewards in life that are, you know, that are really good for me, and that keeps me who I am. I think I'm at a stage in life and in my career that once I'm in this room where I work, or I work in the, you know, take my computer out in the garden or elsewhere, or I can be anywhere, I just continue to work. And when I'm working, everything just fades away. Everything else that might happen in my life, and it really does. I don't sit here thinking about what people might be saying, and it's really, really, you know, I'm really grateful that my work has been you know, acknowledged in the way it has been. And but what the life that I lead and it's, and who I am is very much evolves around writing and continual writing, and those kind of challenges that I set myself, and I've always been like that, and I always take risks, and that's just basically who I am, and. And then when I sit down to, you know, and I'm writing in my head, if I'm not writing on a computer or writing notes, this is what I'm doing all the time. It's maybe I've turned into a writing robot. I don't know, but that's my life. Yeah, go on.
One of the things you've spoken about that makes the writing possible is the fact that you have an indie publisher who has always backed you to the hilt. Can you talk about the power of Giramondo and what their support over your career has done for your ability to write the kind of books you want to write?
Well, Ivor took on Carpentaria, my first novel published with Ivor. That was my second novel. And that novel was really a novel where I had, but you know, had that I had worked to the decisions that I had made about risk taking, challenge, and not being put in a box about how I should write or not write, and Ivor was the, you know, the only publisher in Australia at that time who was prepared to publish Carpentaria as a book that was doing the things that I wanted to do as a writer, starting to do. And Ivor asked me a lot of hard questions about why I wrote the book the way I did, and I gave him my answers. I was still living in Alice Springs at that time, and I didn't think I'd hear from Ivor again. And Ivor said he would publish it. And he was a small, at that time, Ivor was not publishing a lot of books, and he was still working on developing Giramondo. And so, you know, I expected that, you know, he needed to, you know, make money too out of his business. And I'd expect to hear from Ivor again. But he said he would publish it, and I trust Ivor, you know, entirely with my work, and I did then, and I didn't want to change it, you know, to make changes that would take the feel and the context, you know, change the context of my writing, and you know what Carpentaria was doing. He understood what I was trying to do, and he's an exceptional publisher. I think he's the best publisher in the world. I keep saying that. Well, I actually know about a few publishers in the world. I'm just saying it, you know, for the sake of saying it. I know publishers, and I know some of the best publishers in the world, and I reckon Ivor's right up the top there. And not only that, those publishers respect him as well, you know, and respect what he does. And and he does it here in this and in because of his love for this country, and what literature can do in this country. It's I think we're really we should be really pleased and excited about what he does, because it's exceptional.
I think when everyone goes and buys the obligatory copy of Praiseworthy that they have to buy, they will be very thankful indeed. Alexis, we have time for one short question, and I had one that I was going to ask, and then one of my fellow judges from the Stella said, don't you dare leave that stage until you ask her what she's working on next. So, Alexis, what are you writing next for us? Because I believe that Praiseworthy is not necessarily your final epic.
No. No, Praiseworthy came before, a book that I have been wanting to write for some time, and I have been working on it, have working on a lot of research for it, note taking, and busy ideas and thoughts, are filling, you know, starting to fill notebooks, and so I will. Start working on that soon, as soon as I finish with the, you know, with the Stella publicity machine. and then also there's another book I'm working on, and I'll go to the Gulf of Carpentaria in September to work with one of our really important countrymen up there, Murundu Yana, and he's one of the most exciting people that you could ever meet, and you know I'm not just saying that because I think so, a lot of people think so, and his book is just going to be just brilliant. You can see this country as you've never seen it before when you read Rob Murray and Dumet Vienna.
Thank you so much, Alexis. Please, everyone, join me in thanking Alexis Wright.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and to rate our channel.